Hi everyone, welcome back to another edition of Matrix Moments. I'm super excited for this podcast. I have the Razorpay founders, Harshil and Shashank, with me. They need no introduction. We are super privileged to be early investors and partners in the Razorpay journey. And you know, we've seen them grow from sort of the youngest fintech founders when they started 1 or 2 years out of school to now fintech veterans who are inspiring the next set of fintech founders. And mind you, they're still pretty young, but now they're as old as the fintech ecosystem is in India. So super excited for this. And let's dive right in. I'm not going to introduce you guys. Everyone knows you. So talk a little bit about, you know, the beginnings of Razorpay. You were very focused around startups, small businesses, solved an acceptance problem. Then that became very big and you've gone on to large merchants and so on. And now the vision seems to be evolving back to the beginning with a focus again on small businesses and startups and so on. So just talk me through that, how that vision has evolved.
Yeah. When we started Razorpay, right, and the idea for Razorpay came in without any thought of what a startup means or what funding means and everything, right? Like, we were just too folks fresh out of college, two engineers who love to code, and we stumbled upon a problem of accepting payments, and that's when we went around and found that like almost every startup founder, every person who's building something in India was facing that same problem, right? So I think the focus on payments came in because of the empathy that we had for startup founders, because we were a startup founder ourselves, and we felt that if we solve this problem, we'll solve the problem for so many new upcoming startup founders in the country, and this will be one less problem for them to worry about, right? And that is how we started. Of course, as we grew and as we expanded, our vision broadened, and we felt that we don't need to limit ourselves just to small any particular segment. Like, we can solve this problem for almost everyone who wants to distress themselves and who want to accept digital payments in India, right? But if you look at Razorpay's journey, almost all of our product launches, almost all of the things that we have built are built around a problem of a startup founder. Like, that's the personality that we connect most to, because we think like them. So when we started payments, and then we felt a lot of people just want to accept digital payments, they don't care about building a website and all of those things, and that's how payment links came into play, payment pages came into play. We felt a lot of startups were building in B2B space, so that's how things like Smart Collect were born, subscription payments were born, because there were a lot of startup founders building SaaS businesses. So almost all of our products and services have been built around empathy for the startup founder who's building something, and the focus was earlier was to solve for the payments problem for the startup founder. How can we make it easy for them to accept money? How can we make it easy for them to monetize their business? And I think as we kept gone deeper and broader into that, I think in the last couple of years we felt that we can go broader than just accepting money, right? Like, a startup founder is spending a lot of time in multiple other financial operations that are needed when you set up the business. And the empathy was always there, because we remember our early days. We remember the challenges that we faced. We remember how it was so complicated for us to, I used to personally sit and do salary processing 8 hours every month for all the folks who used to work at Razorpay till we were at least 15, 20 employees. I remember how complicated it was to pay TDS, pay PF, pay so many different things on so many different portals, and face all of these issues. So the empathy was always there, and as we reached that scale that, okay, we could go broader than payments, I think that's where our journey moved towards things like X, things like Capital, which we are now building on now.
I think that's sort of a fantastic learning for most people building a product, right? Which is actually develop this empathy for your core user and then identifying this pain point in that user's life. So as you evolved, as you started discovering more of these problems, right? How did you decide that, hey, I want to solve for this set of problems versus another set of problems? And talk to me about balancing, hey, this is an acute pain point, but maybe it can't be solved by product, which I know I'll come back to product ethos, but can't be solved by product, it has to be solved by a lot of operation. So how do you make sense of this, hey, this is big pain point, and then we are the best people to solve it?
I think, actually, good question. I think even when we started, right, you know, we were very much focused on here and now, right? Like, what can we solve right now for businesses for founders, right? Which is very unique and which will bring a lot of differentiation in the market. So when we had started, you know, there was there was nobody who was focusing on startups and the digital SMEs that I like to call, and most of the incumbents are very, very much focused on enterprises, right? So we thought like, okay, how can we simplify the life for founders or for businesses that are starting up? So we were the first ones to launch digital onboarding. We were the first ones to bring extreme amount of focus on, on design and usability around payments, right? Then as we scaled up, two years later, then we started approaching a lot of enterprises and they started coming back to us, hey, we also want similar kind of, the experiences that you guys bring, but with the scale and the reliability and robustness. And at that point, I think we were in the right place, right frame of mind to then start building towards them. There are a lot of problems that we always knew are present, but we couldn't solve for them at a certain point of time. Like take an example of cross-border payments. I've been tracking that problem since when we started, like 2015-16, but we were never in a position to really solve for it in a good way with all the compliances and, regulations and partnerships that it requires. And I think over time, like 2018-19, we sort of kept chipping away at it. And suddenly we were in a position that, now we have like the best cross-border payment stack in the country. And, anyone who is looking to solve for export payments and slowly starting to look solve for import payments, like can work with Razorpay. So that is to say that, at any point of time, it's a question of, our own abilities as well, that what we can do. And second, something that adds a lot of differentiation. Because if you just building something incrementally never works. And honestly, I think we build a lot of stuff. We build a lot of stuff and, probably a lot of them we discard or just goes into maintenance and doesn't do well.
So just double click on that, right? You talked about differentiation, and that's usually like a 10x solve versus like an existing solution in the market. How do you determine, hey, this is a 10x solve for this pain point and this is not?
I think at the starting, you can't really know whether it is a 10x solve. You can do your research, you can talk to customers, you can read the data. Like these are the 3-4 things that are there, like, having good domain knowledge. At least one thing that has worked well for me is to look at it very much from an outsider's perspective. Because the moment you are sort of embedded in the industry, you also adopt the blind spots that the industry has, right? But the moment you sort of look at it from an outside perspective and evaluate it from first principles, saying, why is it something broken? Right? Why is it happening this way? Like, just keep asking why to get the root of the problem. And you might discover certain truths that will feel like that it's sort of incoherent with the way things are happening. And you can hit around that, right? So if you look at the payments aspect itself, when we did digital onboarding, right? When we launched digital onboarding, like paper mandates or paper signatures, that was sort of the norm during the day. And you ask like, why is it like this, right? And there's no clear answer. Like, it's just the way it happens. So that's like the situation for a lot of things. And I think technology breakthrough helps. Like I know the scenario around payroll, for example, I think payroll has been broken for a long time. But taking a very deep tech approach to it and saying, look, we will simplify it and make it a single click with all kinds of product and tech solutioning or whatever you can do. Now, that's really a big delta. And, anytime you talk to a founder and, your own experience, it sort of validates it, right? But how big can it get and whether that 10x really comes through, that you can only know in practice. Like you have to back your gut and say, okay, let's just go and do this and then course correct if it doesn't work out.
Yeah, one of the lens on that is also knowing what our strengths are as a company and where can we produce a delta, right? So, for example, like we know that our strength is tech and product and using tech and product to build around financial flows, build around money flows. So, wherever money flows, we can use tech and product to really make it seamless, make it simpler. But outside money flows, it's not our core strength. So to give an example, right? When we looked at payroll in the end is a money problem. You're discussing
just
money.
Hold that thought for a second, Arshil. So, you guys, I remember maybe a year or so, maybe it's been more than a year. It's hard to keep track of COVID time. But it's been, you guys framed what are all the opportunity sets, right? And that opportunity set was very wide. And, yep. Most payment companies got into lending, then super app, a bunch of things you guys could have done. But then you stuck to your ethos and say, flows and transaction flows are who we are about. And then within that, it seemed like RazorpayX just feels very natural. And now you're really doubling down on it and saying, okay, this is an integral part of the company, or this is where the big vision for the company is going. So what made it click versus all the other opportunities that you had?
Yeah, so it was all about like a couple of things. The first thing is, of course, our knowing what our core segment of customers is. And our core segment of customers has always been startups, right? So it is a problem that is very critical to the core segment that we serve. The second is it plays to our strength. It is a money flow problem, right? How do we use tech and product to make money flow simpler and seamless? And like payments is all about how can we make it easier for our business to receive money. X is broader than that, and how can we use tech and product to make all aspects of money flow that a business needs to do seamless and secure, right? And as we went deeper into it, every problem becomes subset of that problem, right? So like Shashank was talking about payroll. Like payroll in the end of the day is about how do you ensure that you pay an employee? How do you ensure that you pay all the compliance payments associated with the single salary payment? How do you ensure all of those compliance and everything gets done with a single click, right? So in the end, it becomes a money flow problem. There are problems that are connected with this, which a lot of companies might do because you have an opportunity to do that and it builds revenue for you, it builds larger space for you. And we have been very clear that we won't get into a space, like Shashank said, we won't get into a space just because we can, unless we can find a way to differentiate. So unless it plays to our strength, we will not be able to differentiate on it. An example I'll give is when we built payroll, we realized that a lot of people need insurance, right? And we realized insurance is not our core strength. So we partnered with companies who do that well. We brought it into the platform. We built tech and product to make it easy for these companies to get access to it. But we don't really need to manufacture their product ourselves. We can work with companies who do that well and make it on the platform. So there are things that are core to us, which are around money flows. And there are things that are not part of money flows that we'll rather partner up with other folks and bring it on the platform.
You know, one of the things I'm always blown away by every interaction with you guys is how clear you are on what you won't do, right? And I think often in a lot of founder conversations, there is a excitement that you can do this, and then you're not staying true to your ethos. Whereas you're always true to your ethos on product centricity, and you know this is what we are good at, and therefore okay, this feels natural, and really listening to. Okay, this is what we're good at, and therefore we're going to do this. Sorry, I cut you off.
So I wanted to add on the Razorpay X piece on the banking part, right? I think we have evaluated a lot of opportunities in the past, as you said, right? But look at banking, again, from a little bit from an outsider perspective, right? It's a large market, right? Banks are like the largest institutions in the country. But at the same time, it's not, evolved and become like a sort of a mobile first world that we are into, right? The level of experience that you get from, let's say, your WhatsApp or Instagram, the kind of personalization that you get, right? That's not true for banking today. It's the sort of ethos that is there, like it's, one size fits all. And that's the burden that, most large banks carry because they are building for pretty much everyone in India, right? So they have that burden that they have to serve and they have to craft a very well done general product, right? But the kind of experiences that startups need from banking is significantly different, right? Whether you are a one-person company or in an enterprise company or you're growing startup, the level of differentiation that banking can bring for your business, any founder I talk to, right? They always think, it's a place to store money. That's it, right? But in the end, the way I think about it is like, your bank account sort of forms the fundamental core of your financial operations, right? And it can give the kind of level of insights to you that probably what an enterprise business gets from an army of finance people. Your bank account is a sitting pool of genetic tremendous amount of data, right? We talk about our social data and personal data. For a business, what is their personal data? It's their financial data, which is really personal for them and something that can give tremendous value for them, right? And that's not something that is well done today in the ecosystem, right? And the third thing that you look at, right, which is like beyond market size and the current problems, which is our own ability, right? Like we the expertise that I think Razorpay brings to a table is like marrying really good software with banking infrastructure and the money movement flows that are there. And in the end, like banking sits right in the middle of it, right? Like you can build really great software. You can, it's core of financial infrastructure, and there's a lot of money movement involved in that whole thing, right? So it really sits well with the DNA that we have, right? So it's just the combination of these three things that pushed us in that direction.
So I was going to ask you what is neo about neobanking, and you already defined it. So I just want to recap for everyone because you said personalization, Second, that the bank account is the fundamental building block of all your financial and operating flows. And third, you said insights and sort of personal or genetic data of the business.
And let me give a very good analogy, right? So, like in India, you have trains, right? So the trains have this job of getting you from point A to point B, which is what I think the large banks do, right? They do the job of, storing money and helping you initiate transactions, right? But the moment you get off from the train, you have to get to your home, right? Or someone might want to go to a park. Someone will take a rickshaw, someone will take a Mercedes, right? And someone, might just live nearby and will walk, right? So that last level personalization, that last mile delivery of services on banking is something that is completely missing, right? And it was not possible to do earlier, right? Because the technology didn't allow for it. But now everyone has a mobile phone. Everyone has a, mobile connection, right? And that allows you to personalize banking services to the nth extent.
I think it's a fantastic articulation of sort of what is neo about neo banking. Now, how do you go from there to payroll, right? Which seems like one of the, daily very mundane activities. Mm-hmm. And, there is lots of flows, right? So the way I think about it is that you guys solved an acceptance flow, which is sort of inbound flows. And then there's a bunch of internal flows. It could be AP/AR, accounts payable, accounts receivable flows. It could be payroll. There's also an current account operations and opening of accounts flows, you are doing some of that right at a hygiene level. But this is something that you said, okay, we are going to solve it at a 10x level. So how did it go from this is the vision for neo banking, but this is where we start?
Yeah. So when we started building neo banking, right, and the journey started about 2-3 years back. The idea was that we want to simplify all the money flows to the businesses, and all of those are part of it. But we have to start somewhere, right? So the first basic thing you need around it is a central current account and the operations and the way to manage a current account. If you look at the way banks' portals have evolved in the consumer side, they've changed massively in the last 10 years. But if you talk to any small businesses, the way the portals that they interact with or the interface they have, most cases they are not even any portals. They have to sign documents and paperwork. And even if there are portals, they're much, much more terrible compared to what they would get on the consumer side. The first aspect was just to change that, just the basic banking operations. So you have something which looks modern, which looks of today's day and age, where you can open a mobile app and do transfers. And then we started going into the personalization aspect. How do we solve for specific flows? And that is where the problem becomes far more deeper, right? So we had to pick up flow by flow that a business does. And I think the payroll was the first flow that we picked up because it's the most common flow that every business has to do. Even if you have 2 employees or 4 employees or 10 employees, it's extremely complex. It is very periodic. You have to do it on a monthly level. And the starting point was our own empathy to a startup founder. I remember my own journey when we were starting RazorPay, and the most hated part of my job was to sit every month and make those salary payments, then sit on 7th of every month, make those TDS payments, then sit again and make those PF payments. And I would just go back and think, why doesn't somebody make a single click way to do it, right? So I think that empathy built up gave way to that, okay, we knew how deep of a problem payroll is and how much every startup founder is wasting their time and energy and hating every moment that they're doing this or looking for that solution that we are trying to build in. So payroll became that first way into getting these startups, for startup founders' financial lives, that we know you face this problem, we have faced this problem, let's take it out of the door. And you have this one day extra every month that you're not going to spend on payroll now, right? So that is how it started. And over time, we are constantly adding a lot more things around it, like vendor payments, like invoice payments, and a corporate credit card that we launched came from that same empathy. Because when we started RazorPay, even when we had received $11.5 million of funding, no bank would give us a corporate credit card.
Yep.
And I had to use my personal credit card to pay for Amazon bills, to pay for GitHub bills, to pay for Google bills. And I would just wish, hey, I have $11.5 million lying in my account. Why can't you give me a corporate credit card on back of that? But the bank wouldn't be convinced, right? So a lot of these things start from our own journey, startup founders, and then connect back to that. We know how much pain it is and how much time you're wasting in it. And we know that if we go to a founder and say, if somebody had come to us that day and said that we'll give you this software, use this, and you wouldn't have to waste one day in a month doing this.
Yeah,
I know I would have bought that software right on that day. So that's why it's working the way it is.
Yeah, in fact, I'll tell you a story. I think Harshal was, vacationing in Goa, I think back in 2015 sometime. and he had to carry a laptop, and he had to come back to his room near midnight, post 11 p.m. or something like that, and he had to log into his laptop and make the payroll salaries during that vacation in Goa. And it was very interesting, you know, because you have to carry that laptop around because you can't make up the salary payments using any other machine, and nobody else can do it as well, because onboarding someone else on that system is like equally tedious.
And there's no mobile app.
Really hate it.
And what was he doing while you were making the payroll?
All of them were partying. I had to go out, go down, go to the room and like make that payment and say, hey, I'll be back, I'll make the salary payment.
And you're like, yeah, I'm just going, that's your job, go do it.
That summarizes this relationship. Yes. So switching gears a little bit, when you think of this entire space of neobanking, and you know, all of us, you know, founders, most of all, investors, everyone sort of creating this category of banks, and you know, everybody's got some fantastic collaboration with a few partner banks. So something has gotten off the ground, okay? But when you guys think of, hey, this is what's happening in Brazil, this is what's happening in Europe, this is what's happening even in closer markets like Singapore and so on, how do you see this sort of evolving? Where this truly becomes like a category of companies and so on?
Yeah, I think, see, way banking as an ecosystem has evolved, right? Like, it started with what you call typical branch banking. And initially, banks were just a way to store your money safely. That you'd be a large building in every city where you could park your money safely so that nobody steals it, right? And then over time, it evolved, because today you don't go to a bank and deposit money just because they can hold it more safely than you do. But because you can do a lot more with that money when it stays in the bank account. And I'll give a consumer example of it. But today, right, like the reason you put your money in the bank account so that you can use UPI on it, you can have a credit card on it, you can make payments, you can do transfers, you can get access to loans, you can get access to so many more services, right? And that's the way our personal relationship with banking has changed rapidly. But even today, right, like when you look at most banking interfaces, they are built like the traditional branch was built, right? So if you open a bank interface, you log into it and you look at it like counters you would see in a branch, right? Deposits, payments, loans, insurance, right? It is like that's you right. Walk into a bank branch just in a digital world, right? But the point of digitization, the point of technology is not just to bring the physical interface online, it's also about using the technology to make those interfaces more personalized and more insightful. And I don't think that has happened in banking yet, right? Today's digital interfaces of banks are still not really taking advantage of all the technology that we have on available. And an example I will give is your credit card payments, right? Like when you would make a payment online, you would type a lot of these things and everything and make a payment. You were making a payment digitally, but it was not really using the modern mobile phone technology to do it. And then UPI changed that game, because UPI uses the modern stack that we have, the mobile phone that we have, to make that process far more simpler than typing 20 fields and then completing a transaction. I think that needs to go broader into banking itself, that using today's technology to ensure that you do authentication using that, you do approvals using that. When you open the interface doesn't ask which counter do you want to go to today, but instead say, what do you want to do today, right? You want to make salary payments, you click this button and you have everything available when you want to make salary payment. You want to make a vendor payment, you click this button and you get everything, whether it is paying TDS, paying invoice, paying all of those things in one single click. And that's the level of personalization that we need to head towards in banking, right? And So yes, digitization of banking has happened, but I don't think the new age banking has really penetrated the way it should be. And that's what neobanks are all about. That's what they're trying to do in personal space as well as business space.
So before I just hand over to you, you know, in each segment, like if I take consumer, firstly, there are different TGs, right? You can go after HNIs, emerging HNIs, or you can go after the low income segment. Then you can go wealth first in some cases, or spend first in some cases. Similarly, in SME neobanking, some people are just doing current account first, some people are doing payments first, some people are doing APIR first. For somebody new coming into the space, what advice would you have when you say, choose a target segment, choose an approach? How do you make sense of all this?
I think that's the beauty about free market, right? Like different people can take different approaches and ultimately, like, you know, the customers decide which one is the best. I think the advice doesn't change. Whenever you're picking a problem, you always work backward from customer pain point, right? What is the customer pain point that you can identify, where you can create good amount of differentiation, and that's the approach to take, whether, you know, to solve a, any kind of problem that you're solving, even in the neobanking space. I think the additional burden that I would put here is on the compliance side, the regulatory side, like what is, you know, what is doable from a regulatory perspective and what will not sort of run foul of, you know, of the current landscape that is there to an extent, right? So you have to cognizant of the risks that that are present, but that's it. Like, you know, identify a great problem statement that you think neobanking can solve for, and just go from there.
Yeah. Right? One thing, but just want to add is that it's important to know what your core customer base is, right? The reason universal banks are built the way they are because they are universal. They're trying to serve everyone, and that's why they have to build, like, to Shashank's example, like trains, right? Like, they have to bring everything under the sun, and you pick and choose what you want because they don't know what customer base, what kind of customer you are. But the differentiation and advantage of neobanking is that you are going towards the personalization, and the personalization can't happen till you focus on a specific segment. You can't build personalization for all the masses in one go. So you have to pick up certain segments, and that's what everyone is trying to do, right? For us, we picked up that segment as startups and startup founders, that we are here to solve their problems. So we'll pick up and choose the problems that they struggle with the most first, and then go towards other problems over time and expand that market from there.
I think it's a great point. And at least when we looked at this neobanking thesis from our point of view, for us, what changed was now it is possible to build for 1 million, 2 million consumers, customers in one segment and still build a large business. Yeah. And it'll be surprising, but if you take the top 10 banks in the country, some of them only have like 1 million to 2 million accounts. They don't have more than that. And they are big, you know, yeah, $5 to $10 billion type businesses. And so it is actually now possible to take that sliver, and as long as you serve them very sharply, build a humongous business. And that's something that's really changed in this landscape.
I think, I think one other big thing that I think the regulator is also slowly starting to recognize, right? Like, there's still a cost to opening a bank account and maintaining balance in that bank account. Like, you know, in a traditional world, when you are operating through people, through branches, it makes sense. Like, you have to be near to that customer to deliver your services, right? But today in a digital world, right, I mean, having a bank account is like having an entry in a database. Literally, it is like that. Right? You know, there's absolutely no cost associated with it, right? But there's still like a requirement of minimum balances and stuff like that, right? So you know, and while there has been a lot of push in opening bank accounts and this whole thing that happened around Jan Dhan Yojana, and you know, but ultimately, like, driving usage of those bank accounts has still not happened, right? Because, you know, a lot of traditional mindset is still there, like, okay, like, you know, you need to have branches and people near to those customers, right? But the approach to neobanking is changing that fundamentally, right? Because your operations have become a lot more digital. So your cost of opening a bank account and maintaining a bank account goes down drastically, right? And that's something that will, as it translates to reality, will change banking at a very fundamental level.
You talked a little bit about the regulator, right? And obviously they're going to have a big role to play in the evolution of this category. You guys are very big in payments, therefore you have a seat at the table. You guys interact a lot with the regulator. What advice do you have for others? In terms of A, how early or how late they should go to the regulator, and how do you make sure, it's a pretty progressive regulator, how do you make sure that you're sort of not 2 years ahead of regulation, but maybe 6 months to a year ahead of regulation?
Yeah. See, I think the advantage of India is that you have a very progressive regulator, and a lot of innovation that's happened in the fintech ecosystem has been driven by regulator, actually, right? Like, if you talk about UPI and even things like credit and everything, there's a lot of push being driven from regulators. So you don't understand that regulators have certain different objectives, right? Like, and those objectives might be different than yours. They have to worry about the bottom of the bottom of the bottom pyramid guy, and you worry about the cream guy, and that's where a little bit of a difference might come in. What is important is, A, I think, at least in India, the reputation with regulators is very important, right? So once you do something which you know is not fitting right to the regulations, and it gets noticed, right, like, you lose all your edge. From that point onwards, you're always holding your hands behind and trying to figure out a way to work because you have spoiled that reputation. So it's important to maintain and hold that reputation important with the regulator, that they see you as a constructive player in the ecosystem that understands their problems as well, that understands their objectives as well, and is trying to build knowing those objectives. The other thing you can do to manage that, and no matter how small or big you may be, But if you're doing something that's really progressive and you have a certain worldview that it can be good for the ecosystem and it solves for the risks, it's good to just go and tell the regulator, right? It's just good to just, right, if at the worst case, write a letter to the regulator explaining what you're doing, how it's good for the ecosystem, how you are aware of the risks that it may have and how you're solving for those risks. They might not say yes or no still, but at least they'll be aware. And then, and if tomorrow they come and question you on these things, at least you have a standing to say that, okay, we were going with this and this is how we thought about it. Versus blindsiding regulators and then they coming and noticing about it and then coming to you, it puts you in a very tough spot and it goes back to the reputation problem. Like once that reputation is gone, it's very hard to build it back.
I couldn't agree more. And you guys know that we see this across fintechs, especially in our portfolio and in the ecosystem. Whoever has gone to the regulator early and said, this is what we are doing. And there will be tweaks that they add to the flows. There might be some friction initially. But because you have done that, even if something goes wrong later, the regulator actually takes a more lenient view, gives you some room to fix it. Yeah. Versus, you know, you've been doing something for a long period of time, then it's created a problem for them, then it is immediately, that's when it, you know, you get a knee-jerk reaction saying, stop.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
It's very hard to come out of that, you know, reputation loop. So I actually wanted to define, you know, what are the core capabilities to winning in neobanking, and I tried to summarize some of the things that you guys said, right? The first is the product experience, which is as soon as you experience the product for the first time, it's wow, hey, this is built on a new stack.
Yep.
This is built on new tech. So that's one. Second was something which is sort of high frequency, top of mind. Could be payroll, it could be daily spend. It's something where you are moving up in the wallet because for me, users are already using banking solutions.
Absolutely, yeah.
You have to move up in the wallet
from
being the third, fourth card in the wallet to being the number one option that you're thinking about. And I think being there at high frequency or periodicity, like you said, helps you get higher in that banking wallet. And I think the third, which is the most important thing that you guys touched on, is compliance and governance early. Because if you say you want to be a bank and you are not setting high standards of compliance and governance for yourself, then you don't belong in the system.
Yeah.
It does take a big commitment to belong in the ecosystem. Anything I missed other than these three that you guys think about in terms of winning?
No, I think pretty much covers it. I mean, of course, there are a lot of things that we spoke about, like around personalization and around using insights to your advantage, right? And that's one thing that neobanks can do far better than what traditional banks have been able to do, what Shashank spoke about. Just using the data to deliver the next level of experience. And it goes back to the first thing that you said, like the product experience, but a lot of that product experience is built using the data, the trove of data that you build around it. And that's one thing that traditional ecosystems haven't been able to do that well.
Now I have the most important question for Shashank, which is, how do you attract and retain devs? And this everybody will just be glued in and ask you for this answer, because you guys have done a fantastic job of creating this culture for devs without giving away the trade secrets. What are one or two things that you guys are doing differently?
Yeah, I wish there was like a big trade secret to it, which we could protect, right? But, well, you know, at least for me, it boils down to just basics of it, right? You know, we put a high bar on whom we hire, right? We have a rigorous interview process, but at the same time, in that whole interview process, we make the person really feel loved, right? That, you know, the we care about, you know, whoever we are hiring, we care about the candidate experience, we care about that, you know, person who is interviewing with us, like we are taking their time as well, so, you know, they should get some value out of it, right? And right from there, I think we set the expectation around the culture as well, that, you know, we expect anyone who is interviewing that they are representing Razorpay, right? And they should, the people who are there on the other side get a glimpse of what Razorpay is. So it's, in some sense, you know, the whole process acts as a good filter for the kind of people that we attract, right? And once they're inside, you know, the just crafting that whole journey of people, like, you know, from the point of like, what are the problem statements that they're working at? What are their own aspirations in terms of like how they want their career to grow in the organization, right? How we are supporting them from a mentorship perspective, you know, from a managerial perspective. See, one of the simple things is that, you know, if you don't have good managers in the organization, how good people that you have, like, it will somewhere fall down. At a scaled up level, you know, the moment you are beyond, let's say, like 150, 200 people, you know, I think having very good managers is extremely important because they define the experience that, you know, their reportees are going to get, right? So I think we invest a lot in, you know, training our managers and aligning them with the philosophy of the company, which is taking care of employees, but at the same time, like having very high productivity that is there, right?
I think from this conversation, it's clear to me what is different, that it is actually a labor of love for you guys to build this organization. And, you know, you care about how the, you know, this person's lives are from the moment they start their first interaction and especially through sort of an onboarding process.
Absolutely. It can't happen without that, right? Between both me and Herschel, you know, from day one, I've always been like, look, you know, the people who are working with us, like they are giving us their time, their you know, literally blood, sweat and tears, right? And we should do right by them. And everything sort of comes from that philosophy. And, you know, hopefully people also recognize that. And because that's the reason, like, even despite all these years, like, you know, our best people and our oldest folks have kind of stayed with the organization.
Yeah, one of the things that works on the engineering side for us is, right, like, see, engineers today are smart, like, the salaries and everything is table stakes, like, they're looking beyond that in terms of jobs. And a lot of orgs treat engineering as, like, the engineering team as a services company within their own company, right, like, that the business team decides what needs to, what the customer needs, the product team decides, okay, this is how the customer problem is solved, and then you throw it to the engineering that, okay, just build this, right, and, like, nobody enjoys that kind of work environment. Nobody comes to product companies to work like a services arm of the product company, right? The first thing that we are able to do is that both me and Shashank really understand it well, that our core differentiation comes from engineering, right? At the end of the day, people use Razorpay because our success rate is better, because our latency is better, because the algorithms that we have written routes the transactions the best, and all of those things around it, right? And that definition isn't happening because the sales guy said, hey, improve your latency, but it's because the engineering on the ground was able to figure out how to improve that latency through this small interaction or through this micro interaction, right? So first, having that understanding that our differentiation at the end of the day is how we build our product and the engineering depth that our product goes into. Second is then how do you give that freedom and flexibility to the engineer on the ground that whatever they are building, this is the problem they're solving, and they're aware of the problem that they're solving, and they're able to use their own skill set at the end of the day to figure out solutions to the problem and not just say that, okay, just write this code and get this done. When you have those two things available, that's when people start feeling impact in their job, that whatever I'm doing, that's really producing differentiation for my company, and that is producing the impact on the ecosystem. And not just because the sales guy said that this needs to be built, right? So I think that culture has to flow down from the top, and that's how people on the ground start feeling empowered and impactful in their jobs.
And that, you know, that what one thing that Herschel mentioned around impact, I think that's a very important thing. We redesigned our whole review process around, you know, asking people like, oh, hey, what is the impact that you have created? You know, and there's a good amount of conversations that happens in all our calls and corridors, like, you know, the work that I'm doing, like, what is the impact that I'm creating, right? And, you know, how is it useful for the ecosystem, for the company, for the customers that is there? And it's very surprising, like, you know, a lot of engineers, when they come in, and then slowly, like, they have to figure out, like, okay, what is the impact that I'm creating? And then suddenly they have to realize, you know, like, I don't just have to do, like, interesting technical work, but, you know, it needs to have some positive outcomes as well. And then they sort of work backwards from it in some sense and, you know, try and produce the best output, right? So this whole thing around, you know, on the work side, like having a very good customer-focused, impact-driven culture and percolating it to the junior-most folks in the organization, it's a work in progress, but I think it has stood us in good stead.
I think the first time that I've heard you guys actually articulate this view of impact, and I think it's incredibly powerful because most people want their work to have meaning. And I think that impact is actually giving the meaning back to, you know, somebody writing hours and hours of codes, which is fantastic. So closing comments, as you guys, I can't believe you guys are just getting started on this journey, honestly, and I know that's how you think. But as you look forward to this next phase of this journey on, you know, Razorpay becoming potentially a neobank, becoming like a even larger platform, what sort of exciting for you, and, you know, what are the things that sort of think, you know, you view as challenges?
So, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that we are now like fintech veterans, and whenever I hear fintech veteran, I feel absolutely weird. somewhere like still don't accept it fully that it's been like 7-8 years in the industry, right? Because when I look around, you know, I still get excited every day with the kind of work that we are doing and you know, the scale of problems that we are solving, right? What really feels wonderful to me from a neobanking perspective is, you know, that even to this day, like the businesses that are there, they are the heart and soul of the economy, right? And the businesses in the country, the tech startups, the digital SMEs, all of them are on a digitization journey. But fundamentally, by and large, you know, broadly in the ecosystem, digitization today is non-existent. You know, most of the businesses are still operating very manually. You know, and I would say there is like, you know, at least an opportunity for us to improve the productivity of businesses almost by 30% to 40% on a regular basis, right? And when you do that, when you help businesses become more productive, I think it has a direct impact on the economy of the country, you know, in terms of producing more jobs, being more competitive at a global stage, a lot of positive outcomes. And I think, like, you know, at a macro level, like, it should, you know, more from a 5-6 year perspective, like, it should help India become like a $5 trillion GDP, you know, economy, right? So, but connecting back to what we are doing, you know, I think we want to take neobanking to a place where it will practically be doing a disservice to a business if you are not using like modern day neobanking products to make your business more efficient, modern, competitive, and you know, having like access to a set of insights even when you are like a small business, which wouldn't have been possible otherwise.
Cool.
Yeah.
Ashir, anything to add?
Well, I think on similar lines, right? I think like as India is scaling, right? Of course, the entrepreneurship in the country has grown massively in the last 6-7 years. But I think, and we truly believe that like for the $5 trillion GDP goal, there will be a lot more entrepreneurs coming up in this country in the next couple of years. And if Razorpay can play a role in reducing the amount of time and energy and money that they're spending in managing their business finance operations by even 20%, 30%, 40%, and save that time and give it back to them, I think we would have done a great job. We would have created a massive impact on the entire ecosystem, because that is time that is going to be go into building these businesses and scaling up all of these businesses and contributing back to the GDP of the country. So that's the impact that we both are really excited about. And we honestly see that happening today. Like when a customer is using payroll from Razorpay, or when they're using vendor payments from Razorpay, and they call back and said, you guys have just changed my life. I am spending 1 day less, 2 day less every month on doing these things, and that time is going back into my business. That is just the outcome at the end of the day that we love to see.
So what I'm most excited about is that you guys are just beginning this journey, and we continue to be partners along this journey. And I can't wait for what's coming up ahead for Razorpay. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. I am pretty sure that this is one of those podcasts that everyone will have to listen to twice, because it's just unbelievable nuggets that we got during this podcast. Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate the time. That's it from Matrix Moments here.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/matrixmoments. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.